Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.wordpress.com. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of Luke's English Podcast. In this one, my parents are here in Paris visiting for the weekend. And so I thought it would be a perfect opportunity to sit down with my dad for about an hour and interview him and just answer various questions which you, the listeners, have sent in to Luke's English Podcast via the Facebook page. Now, I'll go into that in a moment. But, Dad, are you having a nice weekend here?
Bonjour, Luke. Yes, bonjour. I'm having a very good time. Thank you very much. We've been along the left bank of the River Seine. We've been to Notre Dame, and the weather's nice, and it's really great to be here in Paris.
Can I just ask you, actually, Dad, whereabouts you come from? Where do you come from in the UK exactly?
Well, I was born in the city of Leeds, which is in the north of England. It's in the big county of Yorkshire. But I was brought up in my teenage years in South London. So I'm originally from Yorkshire, but I was brought up in London.
Okay. Do you have an accent?
No, I don't really. I mean, I when I was little, I did have a Yorkshire accent. It's quite a strong accent.
What does it sound like?
It's got flat vowels. Okay, up north. And the vowels are all flat.
That's right. I've heard that sort of in the... I can't do a Yorkshire accent.
And it's very difficult to do a Yorkshire accent, even though I'm trying to. I mean, it turns out to be more like Liverpool, which is completely different. I did have an accent, whatever it's like, when I was at school. And, of course, I got teased when I moved to South London because it was a strong accent. And that soon got rid of it.
It's interesting, that thing about Yorkshire accent having flat vowel sounds. If you know anything about phonetics, you'll know that there are sort of two types of vowel sounds. You've got single vowel sounds or monothongs, and then double vowel sounds, diphthongs. So diphthongs are things like ow, ear, things like that.
Yeah, the vowel changes its quality, as you say.
Like two vowels, ear or ow, things like that. I heard a theory that in some parts of the north of England, there aren't so many diphthongs. That's what you mean by flat vowel sounds.
That's exactly what I mean, yeah. So in Yorkshire, it's particularly pronounced that you don't move your mouth as you say a vowel. It stays the same. For example, we say bath in the north as opposed to bath, and we say path as opposed to a path. But also, if you say in the south of England, you say right as opposed to right, okay. Right is changing, as you say it, right.
It's a diphthong, right.
But in Yorkshire, they'll say right, and it won't change, right.
So it's not I, but right. Interesting, that. Very interesting. The bath and bath thing is not so much a diphthong, more just short vowel sound and a long vowel sound.
Yes.
Bath, bath. I've talked about that before. It's a distinction between north and south of England, that those two sounds. Anyway, on Luke's English Podcast, the Facebook page, yesterday, I wrote this status update inviting my listeners to ask questions, which I would then pose to my dad, Rick. And the status update goes like this. Hello, listeners. I'm with my dad this weekend, and tomorrow I'm going to ask him for... I'm going to interview him for the podcast. Would you like to ask him some questions? Please add your questions for my dad here. His knowledge is encyclopedic, but slightly unreliable. So he's like Wikipedia, but I call him Rickipedia because his name is Rick. So please send us your questions for Rickipedia. And as we stand now on Sunday, there are 30 questions here. And we're not going to be able to deal with all of them. In fact, after about the first 15 questions, I did write a comment saying, that's it, we've had enough questions, please stop. But the questions kept rolling in. In fact, they're still coming in now as we do this. So And we're not going to be able to deal with every single question, I'm afraid. But let's try and get through as many as we can in about an hour.
Okay, I'll try and answer as concisely as I can. And yes, Wikipedia is entirely unreliable.
Really? Okay, so the other viewpoints are available, ladies and gentlemen.
That's right.
First question is from a listener called Hai Tuan. I think that's how to pronounce your name. Can I just say, actually, at the beginning of this episode that it's very difficult for me to pronounce everybody's names correctly. So I'll probably end up pronouncing your names all completely wrong. And I hope you find that funny rather than just outright offensive, okay? So just bear in mind, I don't necessarily know how to pronounce your names, but I'm going to try. I'm going to do my best. So the first one, Hai Tuan. And Hai Tuan begins the message by calling you Sir.
Oh, well, that's very nice of you, Hai Tuan. I haven't been knighted, Sir Rick. The Queen has not invited me to Buckingham Palace to lay the ceremonial sword on my shoulders, but I don't mind being called Sir. It's very respectful. Thank you very much.
Do we call people Sir?
Not so much now. No, we don't. I mean, some shopkeepers or people in restaurants might say Sir, but it's pretty old fashioned now. And I think that, you know, it's falling out of use.
People don't really say it anymore, except, as you said, in shops or restaurants, sales staff or sales assistants.
Even that it's not so common as it was, because when someone comes up to you in the shop and says, oh, hello, can I help you, sir? It has that kind of oily thing about it. Mm. And, you know, I think that people are tending to avoid it now.
So it's not very common to say sir anymore, unlike in France, where people call you monsieur all the time.
Indeed.
Which is very polite and all that kind of thing. Right, so Hai Tuan says, sir, what's the difference between the UK today and the UK 30 years ago? A massive question, which you now have to try and deal with in just a few minutes. So what's the difference between the UK now and the UK 30 years ago? That question received 5 likes. So not only does Hai Tuan want to know this, but 5 other people are interested in your response to that.
Well, I can just think of a few things, just to be brief. The first thing, of course, is that UK today is 30 years older than it was 30 years ago. But but in the early 80s, there was a different atmosphere. There was a lot of tension arising from the Cold War. There was a confrontation with the Eastern Bloc. And, of course, the so-called Iron Curtain was still there. And there was a lot of anxiety about, you know, nuclear missiles being moved into the UK from America, nuclear missiles being moved west of the Urals by the Russians, and all that tension was really quite an anxious period.
Cold War.
Yeah. Cold War. Now, it's a much more relaxed international scene across the whole of Europe, I'm glad to say. The tensions are all about economics. We've had a terrible financial collapse. So now everybody is suffering in one way or another from the fact that the banks, you know, had this terrible explosion and didn't lend enough money. So there's two things. One is international tension has been replaced by a sort of economic difficulty. The other thing, of course, is if you look back 30 years, what an amazing change everywhere. The computer, the personal computer, was only just appearing. Even in the workplace, it was quite a new thing in the early 80s to have a computer on your desk. And we now take it entirely for granted that, you know, we have computer chips are in absolutely everything. But it's only 30 years, you know, since it really started to happen. I can remember the first time I saw a digital watch.
Really?
I can remember the first time I put a calculator in my hand, because I had to have one at work at the BBC to work out the timings of the programme.
Tell me about the digital watch. That probably was in the 80s. Like the
70s, I would think.
Really?
I would guess. But you know, I remember when they suddenly appeared, digital watches. Wow.
What did you think of your first... Well, you didn't buy one, I think.
I've never liked them, but I'm very unusual. Lots and lots of people had digital watches.
What did you think of digital watches when they first arrived?
I thought they were ugly and I didn't like them.
Yeah.
But the reason for that is that I think that the watch with hands on a dial is a brilliant, brilliant design concept.
Mm.
If you think about it, how you glance at it and know what the time is, it's absolutely incredible. A bit of brilliance. But whoever first thought of a clock face.
You say that,
and then the digital watch seemed to be a joint leap backwards, where it gives you figures to tell you what the time is, and I just felt that was a little bit boring.
But wait a minute, you say that it's very easy to read a an old fashioned watch with hands. But I remember having to learn how to read one of those watches, and for example, not my students at school, but children. They take quite a long time to learn that the little hand means the hour and the big hand is the minutes, and that's actually
a bit complex. I suppose so. I had never thought of that, but anyway, I've told you that the little computers that changed everything, of course, were just happening in 30 years ago. And the only other thing about Britain itself is, of course, that the population's increased quite a lot in the last 30 years, mainly through immigration, and it feels that more. It's a more crowded place in the big cities, but also it's an incredibly multicultural country now. Mm. I mean, London isn't the only city where there are so many languages being spoken on the trains or on the tube in London or in the street. And the latest census, where we have a census every 10 years, and the census of 2011, shows that in some of the big cities, only half the people who lived there were actually born in Britain.
Really?
And I think it's a particular characteristic of Britain now that it is phenomenally multicultural. One of the newspaper headlines said, "We are the world."
Mm.
And I actually think that's rather neat. And certainly there aren't very serious ethnic tensions. They're very, localised, minor little problems, but nothing serious at all. People get on with each other really well. I think everyone's accepted that the UK is a fantastically multicultural country.
Mm. The rare occurrences of racial tension are often done by sort of individuals. And, for example, you see these viral videos of someone on a bus who's kind of lost their temper and started shouting in a racist way, but they're always considered to be complete idiots.
Yes, they are.
We have groups like the EDF, the English Defence, the EDL, English Defence League. EDF is an electricity company in France. EDL, English Defence League, and they're a sort of English nationalist group, but they're sort of like stupid idiots. Really.
They are. They are of a type. They're all ill-educated. And they're very small in number, and fortunately they don't have any significance.
I hope that the EDL don't now come looking for me, because I know that they have baseball bats and cricket bats and things. But
yes, that's their method of persuasion.
But I know special kung fu techniques, so if they do, I'll just do a Hadouken, and it won't be a problem. So the UK has changed quite a lot. It's a lot more populated, and we've got, computers and the internet, of course, now. So, yeah, things are changing really rapidly. Andre is the next question. Andre has written the next question, and it says, what does it feel like to be British these days? And it's sort of related to the previous one. How does it feel to be British?
Well, gosh, I can't speak for the other 62 million people who live in Britain, Andre. I mean, I can just tell you my personal view is that I've always quite liked living in Britain, and I've travelled around the world quite a lot, and I've always been very happy to come home. I like all sorts of things about Britain, and I think, most people feel quite comfortable about being British. There is a movement at the moment which is a bit hostile to the European Union, because people think that the EU has in some ways got too big and too powerful, and Britain is probably the most Eurosceptic country of the 27, soon to be 28 members of the EU.
Yeah.
And it's a general feeling, but I don't think it's anything other than a kind of an intellectual debate. I mean, I think that people wonder whether the EU should be reformed so that there it is less bureaucratic and maybe a little bit less wasteful. And this is a perfectly intelligent debate. And I don't think that there is any anxiety about people feeling un-British because they're in the EU. I think that basically it's just a kind of technical debate about what's best for the country.
Yeah, okay. So next question is from Bruno Alves. And this is a question about football. So if you're into football, listen closely. If you're not into football, don't worry about it. because we're only going to talk about it for a couple of minutes. And who knows, you might learn something about football and then you can kind of impress people by saying, oh, well, I know that Lionel Messi didn't score a goal in the latest game, which was a huge surprise. You know, you can sort of wax lyrical about football. But the question is, Dad, which team is going to win the UEFA Champions League this season?
Well, I think, as we're recording this, I think we're down to the semi-final stage, only four teams left.
Wait a minute, what are those four teams?
I can't remember. I Barcelona.
Barcelona. Real Madrid.
Real Madrid, I think. Certainly Bayern Munich.
Someone else.
Basel, somebody, I don't know. Sure. Sorry, isn't it terrible?
There are no British teams left in it.
All I can say is that a few years ago, I was at a conference in Barcelona, and I was fortunate enough to meet a guy who worked for, he was a senior man in Icelandic television. And we fell into conversation, and he said that his TV station had the rights to the Champions League, and therefore he had VIP tickets for the game that was coming up the next evening. Would I like to join him at
Very
the
nice.
New Camp Stadium in Barcelona? I said, yes, please. So I went to this stadium, and it was Barcelona versus Bayern Munich in this incredible stadium, 80,000 people, huge noise.
Mm.
And I felt rather sorry for Bayern Munich having to play in this atmosphere. But they were brilliant. They were very, very cool. They won 3-1. Nobody scored three goals in this stadium for a long, long, long time.
Yeah.
And I was impressed with Bayern Munich. And I've always kept an eye on them since then. And they seem to be a very, very cool team. They're not kind of starstruck. They don't have any extravagantly ridiculous players. And they just they play very, very well. And I think that if I had to bet on who would win the Champions League, I'd go for Bayern Munich.
Okay, cool, calm, collected,
cool, calm,
well-organised German efficiency.
But they've also
win.
Got a lot of flair, but they don't seem to be affected by the atmosphere.
Okay, right. Let's see what happens. We'll see if Rick Thompson's prediction of a German victory this year will come true. I wonder if maybe you can win some money. You should put some money on it, Dad.
I don't feel that confident.
Are you a gambling man?
I'm not. No.
No.
No. I think gambling is for losers, really.
Okay. Except when you win, and then it's. Right, shall I move on to the next question? All right, Stefano Pierini, who I expect is from Italy, but I'm not sure. He says, I'd like to know what he thinks about Eastern Europe, especially the southeastern part, for example, Serbia and bordering states, because I know he worked there sometimes. He works there sometimes. You do work in Serbia occasionally, don't you, Dad?
Yes, I do. I mean, I worked for BBC News for a long time, and now I do training and development work in broadcasting and broadcast journalism in parts of Europe that you know, people feel they need some advice and some help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have done a long project in Serbia. I've been going there occasionally with some colleagues to do some training and other work in radio and television over the past 6 years. And I've also done some work in other parts of Southeast Europe, in Croatia and in Kosovo, in where else? Slovenia. And so I do like that part of the world very much. I think in it, from the perspective of people living in the UK, they don't know much about it. I mean, I think they're pretty ignorant about it.
Yeah.
And they're also, I think there's a bad stereotyping for the Balkans. People say, oh, you're going to Serbia, Rick, is it safe? Well, you know, of course it is. It's a gorgeous country and it's beautiful and some really, really nice people. And all I can say is that I think that if that part of the world continues to make the right kind of progress, it's all based on rule of law, where they've suffered terribly from corruption, corrupt business people, kind of, you know, mafia kind of stuff, and corrupt politicians. And I think that it's improving. And if they can establish rule of law so they have a fair society for people, that's the first point.
Mm.
And it's got great potential. Croatia is going to join the EU on the 1st of July, become the 28th member state. And of course, a lot of people know that Croatia is beautiful and it's got a great coastline down the Adriatic.
Yes.
But I think it's also got a lot of other potential. So I think the whole region has got the potential to grow, and it just needs to face up with some determination to the fact that society has to be fair based on rule of law.
So it's a sort of slightly misunderstood region, but it has a lot to offer. And as long as they can put their slightly difficult past behind them and sort of bring a lot of things to Europe, it's going to they could bring so many things. They have so much to offer.
Yes, I agree.
It's a good holiday destination, isn't it? That part of the world.
It certainly is, and not terribly expensive. And Croatia is known because of its coastline for its holiday potential. But there's other spots that are gorgeous in northern Serbia. Novi Sad is a beautiful place, and they have this big Exit Pop Festival every year in July.
Yeah.
The Exit Pop Festival is sensational.
It's called Exit Pop Festival.
The Exit Pop Festival. It attracts thousands and thousands of people.
Any big bands play?
Yeah, they send. I don't know who's playing this year. You can look it up online. But Novi Sad in northern Serbia is a beautiful place to go to. You can go to Mostar in Bosnia. I mean, there's all sorts of really interesting places to visit in that part of the world.
And now, thanks to Rick Thompson, if you watch the news on TV, it's probably a little bit better than it was before. Mainly thanks to Rick Thompson. So that's what the Thompson family does, isn't it? We save the world through broadcasting.
Well, they certainly have improved the quality of the broadcast news in the last few years. It's not entirely due to me, but it's certainly improving.
That, by the way, my dad works in sort of journalist training for journalists in television and radio broadcasting, and he's been working in Serbia and some other places. Helping them out there. So good job. Well done, Dad. You're sort of doing a very good thing. So next question is from Hiroshi Maruyama, who's from Japan. Do you speak any Japanese, Dad?
I remember arigato gozaimasu. Is that right? Thank you very much.
Arigato gozaimasu.
Arigato gozaimasu.
Arigato gozaimasu, which is like the full version. But then you've got the shorter, more informal version. For example, if you're slightly drunk on a Friday night and you've been eating ramen in a ramen noodle shop in Japan, in Tokyo, that you don't have to do the arigato gozaimasu. You don't have to do the whole thing. You just do the quick version, which is azamasu, which is just azamasu, even just this, which okay. is the super short version. So if next time you eat ramen in a Tokyo noodle bar, Dad, that's how you should say thank you.
I'll practice.
By the way, azamasu means thank you. Thanks, cheers. It's like saying that in Japanese. Anyway, this is not Luke's Japanese podcast. It's not like Luke no Nihongo no podcast. It's not like that. It's just Luke's English podcast. So the question that Hiroshi has is, why did you, Rick, get the good idea to present a drum kit to your sons for Christmas many years ago?
Well, he's very well informed, isn't he?
He's been listening to Luke's English podcast, and he knows that, for example, I think it was back in 1990 or 1991, you and Mum decided that for Christmas you would buy us a drum kit. Now, for listeners, if you don't know what a drum kit is, it's a musical instrument. That's a drum kit. That's the sound of a drum kit, anyway. And my parents bought my brother and me a drum kit for Christmas, and that led to us becoming massive billion-pound-earning rock stars.
Well, they do both play drums very well, that's for sure.
We didn't become rock stars, but we did learn how to play the drums, and we have always enjoyed playing music ever since. So why did you buy us a drum kit?
Well, when I was a little boy, my parents were quite musical, and we used to play music together, sitting around the piano, and I used to hit tin cans and things with knitting needles.
Really?
As a little drummer when I was small. And then when I was at school, I started playing drums. And I played drums in bands in South London, before I went to university. And everybody did in those days.
Wait a minute. What kind of bands did you play in?
Well, they were pop music bands, pop rock bands.
This is like the mid-60s?
We're talking 63, 64, around that time. Everybody was in a band in those days. And you played things like, pop music. You played some American Chuck Berry things, make people dance, but you also played The Hollies, and you played early record by The Who,
A bit of Beatles in there,
Maybe a bit of Beatles even, yes.
Yeah.
So everybody, tried to pick up a guitar and play in those days, and I did play a bit of guitar, but I also played drums. Anyway, so we went on this holiday, if you remember, Luke, to California.
I do remember,
big,
yeah.
Big holiday, go to California, fantastic.
It's great.
And there was a friend of mine who lived there, and we stayed with him for a night or two, and he had a drum kit in his garage. You two sat down and started showing that you had an actual talent for this. You spent a bit of time in the garage with his drum kit.
Yeah.
And we thought, hello, we ought to get them one. Unfortunately, we were living in a house which had a little outbuilding in the garden.
It's like a garage which was not separate, a garage which was not connected to the house.
It was once upon a time a garage, but we used it as their kind of play area where they could hang out.
Kind of garden house, yes. Kind of thing.
So it was, and there weren't any other houses very close to it, so it was okay if they wanted to play drums and play a bit of music in there. It wasn't going to disturb anybody.
So we had a space in the garden where there was a little house that was big enough to fit a drum kit in it. And so Mum and Dad decided, well, we could put a drum kit in the garden house.
That's right.
And it didn't disturb our neighbours too much. And
so that's what we did. And it wasn't a new one, because these things can be extremely expensive. So we got a second-hand drum kit, which was actually quite a nice one. And that's what happened.
Okay, right. Well, thanks.
Well, I'm so glad you both play drums so well. And listeners, they do.
I was just over the moon to get that drum kit, and I then played it for about 1 hour every day, which is just a privilege. Right, next one is from... No, wait a minute. Hiroshi has actually got a few questions, but he's...
Isn't that cheating?
Well, it is just cheating. It's meant to be just one question, but it's Hiroshi, so, you know, we'll let him off.
Okay, quick.
The next question is, have you ever had Tetrisitis? Tetrisitis, of course, is what happens when you play Tetris for a long time, and when you stop playing, you close your eyes, you can still see the Tetris blocks falling in front of your vision. So have you ever had Tetrisitis?
Well, I certainly did. When there was a Game Boy in the house, I certainly did start playing a bit of Tetris, and it is a bit addictive, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I mean, after a while, I don't think I exactly... I had to go to... Tetris Anonymous, of course,
really?
And you have to sit around in a circle and stand up and say, you know, my name is Rick Thompson and I'm a Tetris addict.
I'm a tetraholic.
No, that's not true, all that. The fact is that every now and then, though, you would wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning with the Tetris music going round and round in your head. How's it go?
And then the other one.
And this can be really terrible. Really, really terrible feeling. So you don't want to get tetrisitis. If you find you're getting it, go and get professional treatment.
Go to the doctor. Not Dr. Mario, though. He's not a real doctor, ladies and gentlemen. Right, so, yeah, you have suffered from Tetrisitis, as most of us have, you know, if we play Tetris. So, all right, final question from Hiroshi, and that's about bird watching. Now, some people in some countries think that it's a bit ridiculous that us British people enjoy looking at birds in the wildlife, you know, in the countryside. We like to go out in the countryside with some binoculars and sort of, you know, find some wild birds and have a look. And go, oh, look, what's that? That's an eagle. Oh, my God, it's big. Oh, scary. Or what's that one? Oh, it's beautiful. That's an avocet, you know, and you tick it off your list of birds, right? You like bird watching. Why?
Well, I think it's fairly obvious. I'm not the only one. Obviously, British people are known to like wildlife very much. Our Royal Society for the Protection of Birds has more than 1 million members. Mm. But there are different kinds of bird watchers. Some of them do get a bit obsessive, and they have to go and see rare birds to tick them off on their list, so they've seen more than anybody else. Well, they're a kind of minority. They're called twitchers. I'm not quite sure why they're called twitchers, but they just are.
Yeah.
Anyway, most people are just really bird watchers because they like knowing what's going on around them. They observe them. And the more you find out about birds and the more you know about what they look like and what they sound like and how they behave, the more interesting they become. Mm. And I think that in the old days, 200 years ago, and certainly in medieval times, or in Shakespeare's time, everybody was very much connected with nature. Yeah. They knew everything about the birds and the plants and the seasons. They felt connected with the seasons. And now we live in, 80% of us live in big cities, and we are disconnected from nature. I think it's a great pity that.
Mm.
And I think it's nice to be able to hear a bird at this time of year in the spring singing and know what it is and know something about it.
Mm.
So that's why I advocate people to find out a little bit about birds, take a notice of them, have a look at them. What are they doing? And see if you can identify them.
Usually they're just flying around, aren't they? Or just
always doing pecking, something interesting.
Pecking things. But no, they are beautiful. I love bird watching too. And if you have a good look, a lot of people, when you say birds, they just think pigeons, don't they? You know, I don't like birds, but they mean that they don't like pigeons or, you know, seagulls or something. But there are so many more birds, and they're often very beautiful, beautiful plumage, and they sing nicely as well.
Brilliantly. I was listening to a blackbird, quite a common bird, the blackbird singing in our garden just before we came here. Unbelievably beautiful.
Blackbird, that's not a crow, because everyone always thinks that a blackbird is a crow. Crows are large birds that are black, and they go, ah, 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 like that. But a blackbird is like from that Paul McCartney song, Blackbird.
Indeed.
How does the blackbird song go?
Oh, dear, I can't... It is very, very lazy and fluent, okay?
Sounds a bit like me.
It does these phrases which go do-de-do-de-do-de-do, and then it finishes with a very sharp bit at the end, a kind of little extra bit, and every phrase is different every time it does it. It never repeats anything. So the blackbird has this fluent, lazy sound.
Wow, okay. So listen out, ladies and gentlemen, next time you're in the countryside, listen to the birds. They're pretty beautiful, actually. Or pretty beautiful. Sorry, I dropped a T there, didn't I? Sorry about that. My dad normally doesn't like it when I do that. But he's cool with it these days. Right, so next question is from Francesco. And he says, good afternoon, Mr. Thompson. How did he know it was the afternoon, I wonder?
Well, he was probably guessing, but good afternoon, Francesco.
A few months ago, Luke uploaded an episode about the Maya people and their prophecy about the end of the world. What do you think about them? What do you think about the Mayans and their, you know, apparent prophecies about the end of the world?
Well, I mean, I don't want to waste too much time on this one. Obviously, the prophecies of the end of the world are completely nuts, and anybody who believes in these things could need their head examining. But I think the Mayans actually have been misreported on this. I don't really think that the whole Mayan culture was devoted to the idea the world was going to end at a certain time and a certain day. It's just the way it's been interpreted. I mean, obviously, these bizarre beliefs are complete nonsense, and I'm saying that with total confidence. If we all get destroyed tomorrow, I shall retract that statement.
Yeah, okay. If the world ends tomorrow,
yes,
then you'll apologise.
I'll say I'm sorry, yes.
If the world ends tomorrow, you'll apologise on Tuesday. How about that? Okay, so next one is from Rom Hine. And Rom says, hi, Luke's dad.
Hi, Rom.
I'd like to know, what are your thoughts about French people, and it can be on any topic. So, what do you think of French people in general?
Well, here I'm in France. The gap between Britain and France is only a short piece of water. The French call it La Manche. We call it the English Channel. It's about 30 kilometres wide at its narrowest point. Not very far apart, but the cultures are pretty different, and our historical backgrounds are different. The French, I think everybody would agree, have got style. They're known for, you know, fashion and art and being very creative. I think the French cuisine is quite rightly got a great reputation. You can get a fantastic meal in France, even in cheap little cafes and restaurants and little hotels. The food is always good.
Mm.
And, of course, the wine is good.
Mm.
And so, France also has a whole range of different cultures and scenery. It's a huge country. Yeah. I think that...
What about the people, though, then?
Well, I think that Parisians are known to be just a little bit rude.
Mm.
And I think that's a pity. I think it's probably true.
See, the thing is that... Yeah, a lot of French people I speak to agree on that. I say to I say to Parisians, what do Parisian people really like? And they go, well, we're all really rude to each other. But they're kind of, they've just decided that that's how they're going to be with each other. But when you meet French people in sort of more close terms, they're very nice, aren't they?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think that the interesting difference, the French have a bit of an issue with British culture. Really? Partly because the, you know, the language is a little bit intrusive, and you know, yeah. Because it's become the international language. Also, they talk about the Anglo-Saxon way of doing things. I'm not quite sure what they mean by that, but I guess it's because they think it is too boring, too pedestrian, too matter-of-fact, too pragmatic.
Coldly pragmatic.
Yes. So not enough passion. The head rules the heart as opposed to the heart rules the head. And the French, I think, celebrate the idea that they are creative and slightly mysterious. So that's reflected in the cinema. And I think that's vive la différence is all I can say.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. I think there's a bit of a change in France these days in terms of their relationship to the UK. I mean, I noticed that they seem to think a lot of English things are cool these days. Like, you know, Marks and Spencers is very popular. And you see the British flag popping up in some places. Like, people go around wearing T-shirts with the British flag on it.
Cool Britannia, it's called, this fashion thing. Yes, I know, Burberry's are very fashionable and things that are archetypally English, or indeed Scottish. There's a bit of a trend to have Scottish, like, tartan in clothes and things like that.
Yeah. Just because we're cool.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, Jairo asked a question, but we're going to come back to that. Instead, we're going to move on to Luciana's question. I think it's Luciana, or maybe Luciana. Luciana. And she said, ask him if he can speak Portuguese or any other language. Well?
No. Next question. Actually, I can speak some French, but I don't speak it terribly well because I don't practice it. But, I mean, I could get by, and I wish I did speak it better. But my excuse is that wherever I go, everyone seems to speak fantastically good English. So it's really quite difficult to you know, force yourself to speak bad Spanish or even bad Serbian when everybody comes back at you with very good English.
You know why they all speak good English now?
Why?
Because they've all been listening to Luke's English podcast.
Oh, I see, of course, yes.
So no Portuguese then in your vocabulary?
Sorry, no.
No? All right. Sorry about that, Luciana.
I have been to Portugal. I did a training course in Porto, which I like very much. I've been to Lisbon, and I've been to the south coast of Portugal, but not for any length of time. Just, you know, just a few days, then rush home again, okay. And not really had the chance to learn any Portuguese.
All right. Next one is from Jarowina, and the message goes: Hi, Mr. Thompson. What do you think about Spanish bullfighting? Spanish bullfighting. So it's matadors, picadors, toreadors, anything with doors on the end of it. Bullfighting, it's been a very important part of Spanish culture for many, many years. It's considered to be not only a kind of sport, but an art form as well. And it's a celebrated aspect of Spanish culture, but these days it's controversial because of the whole cruelty to animals debate.
Yes.
But you've seen a few bullfights.
Well, I've seen two six bull bullfights in my time because I wanted to see what it was like, and I didn't like either of them at all.
Really?
And I do understand that it is part of Spanish culture and tradition, but I don't know whether it. All the razzmatazz and the costumes and the ritual and everything else, for me, it doesn't justify what I think is cruelty to animals. And I particularly disliked the picadors and horseback making the bull, ramming their lances into the bull to weaken it before the matador comes out. And I think that... if you look back at the relationship between human beings and animals over time, there has been a lot of cruelty to animals for entertainment. Yeah. And in our country, it wasn't quite the same glamorous thing that bullfighting is. It was more the people's sports of bear baiting, very popular in Shakespeare's time.
What was bear based?
Oh, a bear would be caught and would be tied, chained to a pole, and then they set dogs on it, and people bet on how many dogs it kills. So, and same with cockfighting, which is very popular working person's sport.
Two male chickens fighting
each other. That's right, to the death. Yeah. And dog fighting, and dogs against badgers, and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I know bullfighting is slightly different, but there's something I really dislike about it being in an arena. The bull is in a completely artificial situation.
Yeah.
And I don't like it at all. And all I can say is that if it stopped tomorrow, I don't think the world would be a worse place.
Okay, there you go. You laid your cards quite confidently on the table with that one. It's interesting debate, isn't it, bullfighting? I wonder what's going to happen to it. Do leave your comments on the podcast if you have something to say about any of these topics. Let's move on to the next question, which is written in Cyrillic. The name is in Cyrillic, which is the sort of Russian alphabet. I can't read it. Can you read Cyrillic?
Oh, no, with great difficulty. No.
Well, anyway, the name is in Cyrillic, so I'm afraid I don't know how to pronounce your name, whoever you are. But the question is, hi, Luke. Please ask him what he thinks about life in the UK. What are the best and worst things? You've already talked a little bit about life in the UK, but can you just pick out two of the best things and two of the worst things? Well, two good things and two bad things about life.
All right, I'll pick two, just like that. First of all, I do like the variety of scenery in the UK.
Scenery, the landscape.
Yes, the landscape, because these islands have a very interesting geology, and therefore there's a huge contrast in the landscapes from Scotland's wonderful, wild, rounded, ice-scraped mountains to the cliffs on the west coast of Wales and Ireland, to the luscious green lands in central England, and then of course the wonderful landscape of Yorkshire, which is the best of them all.
Really?
But it is a huge variety of landscapes, and I know sometimes people rush to London, they don't have much time, they see Buckingham Palace, they see the Houses of Parliament, there's Big Ben. Yes, I've done Britain. Well, you haven't. It'd be great if you could spend just a little bit longer to go to Scotland or north of England or maybe down to the southwest to Cornwall.
And not just Edinburgh in Scotland, but go to the countryside, go to the Highlands if you can. It's amazing landscape.
There's loads of wonderful coast, of course, because it's an island. It has coast all the way around.
Yep.
But there's some beautiful scenery in Britain. The second thing I would advocate about the UK is, from a personal point of view, is the broadcasting.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, I did work for the BBC for a long time. It does have a reputation, which I think is correct. I was proud to work for this organisation. And of course, I'm mentioning it, not just the BBC, but television and radio in general in the UK, is something that you realise how good it is when you go to other places. And I've been to lots and lots of other places. And you suddenly realise that we're very lucky in the UK, that we have so many programmes which are innovative, different, high quality, challenging, not formulaic. Only in Britain could you have programs like Monty Python's Flying Circus. Nobody else could possibly see why you would do that.
Yeah.
And it's not just the slightly crazy programs. There is a whole range of programs which have done very, very well because the people who work in this industry have an absolute dedication to excellence. It must be perfect. And it's a tradition now that our broadcasting is very high quality and very interesting. So I think that's one of the reasons I like living in the UK, because I can enjoy television and radio very high quality.
BBC TV. I love the BBC documentaries about music. And on BBC Four, which is one of the TV stations in England, you regularly have really fantastic, very in-depth documentaries about different genres of music. Or, you know, for example, I've seen documentaries about blues guitarists, jazz musicians from America. There was a documentary about Jeff Lynne, who was the songwriter in ELO, the Electric Light Orchestra, and he worked with George Harrison and stuff. And you can learn so much from watching these programs. I sound like I'm selling the BBC at this point. I don't work for the BBC. I don't have any kind of interest in them. I just think they're very good. A lot of it's on. A lot of those documentaries are on YouTube now.
Yes, I think the Jeff Lynne was. It's a long one, isn't it? It's a long documentary.
2 hours or something.
But, of course, he was an extraordinary producer. And Luke was brought up just living near Birmingham and in the middle of England. And Jeff Lynne is one of a bunch of musicians who came from Birmingham. And he's a very, very talented guy.
Yeah. Jeff Lynne. Check him out on YouTube. Electric Light Orchestra, ELO. Have a look. He's also worked with the Beatles, as I said. Free as a Bird, which was the Beatles' kind of comeback single that they released in 1996. That's another story, ladies and gentlemen. So there you go. Those are two of your favourite things. What are two of the bad things, though?
Well, I think in the towns, I get very fed up that people drop litter on the floor.
Littering.
Why do people drop things on the ground? It's you know, I don't want to live in a rubbish dump. And I think the world is divided between those who drop litter and those who pick it up.
Yeah.
And so when I become president of everything, anybody who drops litter will be either sent to jail for life, or they'll have their hands cut off, and then they'll never do it again.
But if they have their hands cut off, then they won't be able to pick up litter.
Yeah, good point. Maybe I'll just commute that to life sentence of picking up litter.
What you should do is you should chop their hands off. We're joking, by the way. What you should do is you should chop their hands off and have their hands replaced by those, you know, those kind of like metal things that grab, things that street cleaners use to pick up litter from the floor. It's like a metal arm with like two grabbing fingers on the end. You should just replace their hands with those, and then all they would be able to do is pick up litter.
Okay, good plan. Well, we'll go for that. Okay. What don't I like about Britain? I don't like the class system that still exists. It's still there. It's not as rigid as it was, but it is still there, and I don't like the fact that so many people from privileged, rich backgrounds who went to expensive private schools get themselves into a position of power and influence, including in our present government, where a lot of them are from this background. And you look at it and you say, this is the year 2013. How have we come to this, that this David Cameron government is full of rich toffs, and the difference between the poorest people and the richest people in our country just continues to get wider and wider and wider. And this is something I really dislike. I would like a fairer society, and I would like to think that this London social group of privileged people shouldn't have as much influence as they have.
These are the people who went to Eton School.
Yes, Eton is the favourite one, but there are other expensive private schools, and they are from families where they believe they have a right to be the governing class.
Yeah.
And I don't think they do have the right.
Okay, all right, bit of politics there, ladies and gentlemen. Let's move on to a question from Claudio, and he says, according to your dad, what are the most common stereotypes about Italy and Italians? So, just to be clear, ladies and gentlemen, we're now going to talk a little bit about the stereotypes for Italians, not my dad's actual opinion. Let's start with the commonly held stereotypes of Italian people.
Well, I bet Claudio knows what the stereotypes of Italians are.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, the Italians like the good life, la bella vita, and they have a reputation for not working very hard.
Yeah, really?
Well, no, but obviously if you live in a beautiful country like Italy, you have to have time to enjoy the good life, and maybe sitting in a cafe is a better thing to do than going to work. But that's a stereotype. Another stereotype, of course, is they're oversexed.
They like sex.
Well, oversex means that they think about it all the time, and we know very well that you know, Italian men think about it all the time.
Yeah, but come on, in fact, men think about it all the time.
Italian men think about it all the time, like even more, when they're unconscious.
So men, wait a minute, men think about sex all the time, but Italian men think about sex like more than, they think about sex 25 hours a day, maybe?
You have to admit it's a stereotype as well.
It's a stereotype.
Okay, fine. But the other thing, of course, is they're glamorous, very stylish, they like to dress up and show off, and, you know, parade about the place.
And I think there's also a bit of a stereotype about, still about the mafia running Italy.
Yeah, really?
Just a little bit, I think so. Silvio Berlusconi hasn't helped in his image of Italy. I mean, what a terrible shame that he's been in such a prominent position and the rest of the world think he's a disreputable clown, but people in Italy keep on voting for him. But as we record this, at this moment, a new Italian government is being sworn in. Yeah. And he's not a minister, though, of course, his party is in prominent position in this coalition. But I think it looks good at the moment. So fingers crossed that this is a coalition with the main parties working together to try to solve Italy's economic problems. And they have to do something about it.
Yeah.
So I very, very much hope that it will be a good start for Italy to climb out of this difficult period it's been through in the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, so, you know, good luck, Italy. Despite the stereotype that they don't work hard, I know for a fact that, you know, many Italian people work harder now than they've ever done before.
Of course.
So it's not really true that they don't work hard. They work extremely hard. I know that they do, because I've seen it actually happen in front of my face with Italian students that I've met. They've got a good sense of humour as well, the Italians. They're funny people. Right, Claudio also asks you about Margaret Thatcher, but we're not going to go into that because, I mean, so much has been said about Margaret Thatcher in the last few weeks, and also I plan to do a podcast just about Margaret Thatcher in which I deal with all of the different aspects of, you know, Margaret Thatcher, the person, the myth, the politician, and so on. But he does ask you, what's your favourite food? And that ties in quite nicely with a question from Anna Kazan, who's from Russia. And Anna says, please ask your dad what his favourite dishes are. What does he think about English food? What do you have for breakfast, lunch and dinner, etc.? And do you have high tea? So that's actually four questions in one, Anna. How did you manage to squeeze four questions into one? I don't know. But let's start with
breakfast. Breakfast. I mean, like a lot of people in our country, I like nice, freshly squeezed orange juice for breakfast in the morning. I don't really feel as though the day has started. I've squeezed my oranges and had that. I do like some nice, freshly baked bread as toasted, with a little bit of honey on it, or sometimes a little bit of jam.
Yeah.
And I quite often have a grilled tomato.
Grilled tomato on toast?
Grilled tomato on toast, because you know that tomato is good for you, especially when it's been cooked. Sorry. It is very good for you.
Yeah,
yeah, it's got anti-carcinogenics in it.
Yeah.
It's got all sorts of good things in it. So it's a you know, that kind of thing.
Grilled tomato on
grilled
toast.
Grilled tomato on toast.
Maybe a bit of honey, freshly squeezed orange juice.
There probably you go. A bit sometimes I have a yoghurt.
Yeah.
Good for you. And on a Sunday, especially if we have some visitors around, sometimes we have an English breakfast as a kind of a brunch.
Yes.
And that Luke and his brother James will know this, because if they're with us for the weekend, we normally will have a late Sunday breakfast, which will be fried egg, bacon, mushrooms, a little bit of tomato.
Yeah.
The English breakfast. And it is a nice thing to have. But you shouldn't have it too often, otherwise it's a bit unhealthy.
I think a lot of people think that English people eat a full English breakfast every day, but that's ridiculous, because if you did that, you'd probably, you'd die after about eight days.
An occasional treat.
Yeah, so we have, you know, normal breakfast, toast and orange juice, like most other people, but full English breakfast at the weekend or on a, you know, when you've got friends or family with you or something like that. So what about high tea? Wait a minute. High tea means when you gather round in the late afternoon and you eat sandwiches and maybe have some cake or something, and you drink tea served in rather nice, using a rather nice tea set. That's cups and saucers, a teapot and a milk jug. You know, that kind of stereotype image. Do you drink high tea? Do you sit there going, lovely tea, and it's all very English? Do you do that?
No, certainly not. And I don't think very many people will. But it used to be, certainly used to be a middle-class way of life. My grandmother, who lived up in Yorkshire, she used to always produce a little trolley. A little trolley would come along the hall and come into the living room, a little trolley,
yeah,
at about 4 or 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
And there would be a plate of ham sandwiches and cucumber sandwiches.
and a couple of cakes, maybe an eclair, and a pot of tea. We had a very nice China tea service with flowers on the cups. Well, that's a very old-fashioned idea now, and of course, you know, we don't. If you in the afternoon, you might have a coffee and a biscuit, but that's about as far as it goes.
Yeah, I think it's more common. To be honest, English people do drink tea a lot, but we don't really drink it. You don't have high tea anymore, except maybe very posh people or, you know, the royal family or something. But most English people will drink a lot of tea, but they drink it out of a mug, you know, like a coffee mug. And you tend to brew it by just putting the tea bag directly into the mug. You have some milk in it, and you maybe have a few biscuits.
I would not recommend the tea bag and the mug. I'm sorry. I think you've got to invest in a teapot.
Yeah.
That's the only way tea really tastes properly. As for favourite food, gosh, all I'd say is that I've always liked chicken. Yeah. Now, chicken is an unglamorous food. It's not a very expensive food. But I think it's underrated. I think you can do chicken in so many different ways, and it's always good, and it's very healthy. Good for you. So I would say I like chicken. And the other thing, of course, is that there's traditionally British things that I quite like, and particularly in the north of England. The great traditional foods are what we call game. They are foods which have been from wild creatures.
Wild animals, you know.
Venison, for example. We are overrun with deer in Britain, and so there's quite a lot of venison around now, as people have to cull the deer on their farms or estates. And venison is fantastically good for you. And it's so I would recommend it.
Okay. What do you call a deer with no eyes?
No idea.
No idea. That's right. That's a joke, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I picked up on it pretty fast. I thought that wasn't too bad.
Well done. What do you call a deer with no eyes and no legs?
Tell me.
Still no idea.
Oh, very good. That's actually not a very nice joke, is it?
Well, because now you're thinking of a deer with no eyes and no legs. But it's just a surreal image. It's not meant to be... it's not meant to be cruel against animals or anything. It's just a joke. I'm sorry.
Is deer more expensive than lamb or sheep meat?
Is deer meat, like venison, more expensive than lamb or sheep?
I think you'll find that venison is deer, but mutton is sheep.
That was worse than my no idea joke. Because no one understood that.
No, they won't understand it. Let's move on.
35% of my listeners understood my joke. But none of them understood your joke. I'm going to have to explain that somehow.
Don't.
Okay, I plan to do an episode all about jokes. I've been saying that for years, and I'll do it eventually. And it'll be awful, because it won't be funny, because I'll say all these jokes, and then people will say, what, that's not funny? And then I'll explain them, and then they'll understand it, but they still won't find it funny. Anyway, next. We're not going to be able to answer all these questions, ladies and gentlemen, because we've got... we've got dinner coming. We've only got a few minutes left, and then we've got to go and have dinner. So let's see. Okay. Mariana Ramirez asked several questions, but one of them was: do you have any funny anecdotes or stories of me and my brother when we were children?
Well, yes, I can think of a few. Luke was his older brother used to look after Luke because, you know, that's what older brothers are supposed to do. And when Luke was little, he used to be very, very quiet. Now it's difficult to imagine, isn't it, listeners, that Luke was very, very quiet little boy. But his older brother James was very, very talkative, and he would talk and talk and talk. And Luke obviously didn't feel that he could compete with this when he was smaller. So he used to follow James around like a little dog. And when anyone asked Luke to say something, he would say, James, say it. He would ask for James to speak on his behalf.
Yeah.
And we would start wondering whether he'd ever start talking properly. Then suddenly, boom, he started talking. So that's one thing. He used to be very quiet and asked James to speak for him.
But you know why I did that, of course? Because James, you know, was so talkative that if I opened my mouth, he would just interrupt me within the first few minutes. So I just would think, oh, well, someone asked me a question, well, just let James answer because he's only going to interrupt me anyway. And it's only now that I have my own podcast that I'm able to catch up and actually do some talking now.
And the other thing was
maybe
that
too much.
When Luke was small, and he obviously wanted to get away.
Really?
From the family, because you used to make a kind of escape bids every now and then.
Try and escape.
You had a terrible habit of suddenly taking off and running.
Really?
As fast as you could run.
I just run away?
You just run. There was one occasion when we got to a beach in France and we parked the car and we got you and James out of the car and turned our back for a moment and you'd just gone. Where's Luke? He was there a second ago and now he's gone. And it was very worrying. And we kind of zoomed out in all directions. One going one way, one going the other way. Where the heck is he? And your Uncle Nick said, there he is. And there was this tiny little figure running like heck down the beach
in the distance,
as fast as you could in the distance. So we had to run after and catch you. And it wasn't the only time you went for a run. I mean, maybe you'd been in the car for so long that you couldn't wait to start running.
I think what it was that, you know, once I learned how to walk and run, I just thought, right, screw this. I'm out of here. screw you losers. I'm going to the beach. See ya. Maybe it was just because I'd been in the car and I had all this energy and I was like, I've got so much energy, just run for it. I don't care which direction, I'm just running because of too much energy.
But it meant we had to keep a very close eye on you because if you kind of just turned away for a second, he'd be off.
Yeah. I'm running.
There he goes again.
I'm going to run to Japan and now I'm going to run to France. Oh dear, I'm still doing it. Okay, right. So there you go, Mariana. Hope you enjoyed those stories. And so we're coming to an end here. I think we're not going to, as I said, we can't answer all of these questions. Sorry, but that's just the way it is. We're too popular. The podcast is too popular. Ubiratan Silva says, "Why does 2 + 2 = 4? Why when 2 + 2 = 4? Why?"
I don't know what kind of a question that is. It just is. It just does. If you have two cakes and somebody gives you two more cakes, you've got four cakes. Ubi, don't you understand that?
Yeah, but I mean, why though, if you have two? Why isn't it two? Why, for example, isn't it that when you put two with something, why doesn't like another one arrive?
I'm sorry, you're struggling. Look, the answer to his question is because it just does.
Okay, there you go. That sounds to me like that's what teachers say when they don't know the answer. They just go, but just because it is, all right, next question. Don't be too clever, Ubiratan. Yeah, okay. Two cakes plus another two cakes is four cakes, isn't it? But what happens if you eat one?
Well, you've just minused one cake.
Right, okay. I think I've eaten it. I haven't minused it. I've just eaten it. What about two hamburgers plus two Americans? What do you get?
You get two Americans.
I think that's exactly. Okay, that was a joke, ladies and gentlemen. Well done for not really getting it. It wasn't very funny, was it? So maybe someone laughed. There might be someone on public transport just trying not to laugh. Or someone on public transport just trying not to stop listening to this. Well, we've nearly finished. And I'm going to go back to Jairo's question from earlier on. And he asked about, well, he mentions Oprah Winfrey. Now, Oprah Winfrey is the famous American chat show host. And she would end her interviews typically with a question. And the question is, what are you sure of? What are you certain about? What are you sure of? There are so many things to be uncertain about in the world. What's going to happen in the future? Who's going to win the UEFA Champions League? Were the Mayans right? We don't really know. We can't be sure. But what are you certain of?
Well, I am certain of at least one thing.
What's that?
That is that Luke's English podcast is the best way of learning real spoken English as it is spoken in the UK and entertaining to boot. I will also add, I'm pretty sure that love is all you need.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I think on that romantic note, we're going to draw this podcast to a close. And Dad, would you like to join me in a bye, 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 bye?
I can, yes. Okay. That's the way you always finish, isn't
That's
it?
That's how I always finish these episodes. So thanks again for listening to Luke's English Podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes in the near future. But for now,
Bye.
Thanks again for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, you can visit teacherluke.wordpress.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.